This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
In the name of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the beneficent, the merciful, the almighty, we begin. It is He we worship alone, and it is He we ask for help. Inshallah, thank you. Assalamu alaikum, brothers and sisters in Islam. We welcome you to today's talk, which is, the title is God and the concept of God. Can there be more than one God? Can there actually be a God as well? And today's talk, unfortunately, Hamza Zortis is not present. We have a brother, a good replacement, Abdullah Al-Andalusi here. And inshallah, he'll be doing the talk today. And inshallah, by the way, we also have recording, so just to make sure that no sisters will be recorded as well in the video. Inshallah, I'll present Hamza Abdullah Al-Andalusi to you today.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على نبينا محمد وعلى آله الطيبين وصحبه الصالحين السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. Sisters, I'd like to thank the City University ISOC for inviting me today. In case you're wondering, Al-Andalus, yes, I am from Spain and Portugal, but don't say I'm Spanish, I'm Portuguese. But And obviously, in the tradition of anyone that's from the Muslim land of, or used to be Muslim land, obviously Spain and Portugal, I call myself Al-Andalusi. Inshallah, again, maybe. Now, I think the topic today in this discussion is, does God exist? And how do we know if He's one or not? You know, what is this? These are questions that a lot of people, atheists are going to ask, Christians are going to ask, Hindus are going to ask, well, Muslims are going to ask. And it's very important that we don't just believe things with blind faith, but we actually question and we see if it's deducible. Very specifically, the Islamic claim that there's such an individual called a Hanif, a person who believes in monotheism, and comes to this conclusion by themselves, by their own thinking processes. There's no revelation is required for this. This is something that should be thought about and come to that conclusion. So if this is the case, how do we do this? How does someone in any culture come to the conclusion that God exists and that there is only one God? Inshallah, we'll discuss the first premise, that how do we know that God exists? First, I want to discuss the principle, what's called of causality. Causality, as some of you might really know, is that something is caused by something else. Generally speaking, the principle of causality encompasses things within time, so obviously there is a prior stage, and then the next stage, each stage is caused by the previous one. However, I want to ask something more fundamental, because a person might say, well, I can just believe something always existed, or why does there have to be causality for everything? Okay, why does causality, or how do we know causality exists for anything we see? Now, there's nothing natural and everything's man-made. I was going to use an object, but if I was to hold up a rock, yeah, obviously I was going to hold this up, people might say, well, we know this is man-made, we know this was created. But if I was to hold up a rock, and the rock is just someone that you get from, it's naturally occurring rock you get from the ground. Now, how do we know that this rock was created? I mean, obviously, human beings didn't make rocks. We didn't make it. So we can't say that I've seen a rock being made by human beings, so I know it was created. No, we can't say that. So how do we know that rocks were created if we haven't seen, if human beings haven't manufactured it? And what we notice about the rock, or any object you'll see, is it has a certain size or shape or color, definition, certain mass or volume, or any other kind of area of measurement, which a scientist or physicist will start measuring. So, the simple question is that any object you see, or any force that occurs in nature, has certain limitations of its existence, certain parameters it operates in. Now, the simple question is, what gave that object, or that force, its parameters, its limits, its measurements? I mean, why the rock, if I was to hold a rock this big, why is it not twice as big? Or why is it not half as big? Why is it not blue instead of grey, or what have you? Why is it that specific limitation that it has? And the only natural conclusion would be that, well, whatever process caused it to come into existence, this process caused it to come into existence with that specific attribute. And the job of a scientist is now to investigate what process caused that particular kind of rock to have its colour, its shape, its smoothness or jaggedness or what have you. But as a general rule, there can only be three possibilities when we examine any object or any phenomenon that we can observe. One, that this object made itself. Two, that this modern object has always existed as it is, eternally. Or three, that it was made by something else. Now, I'm not talking about God here, I'm not talking about theology, I'm not talking about... This is very simple, common sense, everyday thinking. An atheist, a theist, we can all agree on this very simple, common sense thinking. So, let's examine the first part of the possibility. Did an object, let's say this imaginary rock I'm holding, did it make itself? Well, that's absurd, because in order to make itself, it has to exist, and if it doesn't exist, then how can it make itself? This is obviously clear-cut absurd. We all can agree on this. Has it always been the way it was? So has it existed eternally in this shape? Has it always been like this? Well, if it has always been eternally in that shape that it was, then why is it not bigger than it is, or half the size it is, or different colour? Why that specific? You arrive at the same problem of it has certain limitations. These limitations are limited. It's obviously limited, it's finite, it has parameters. What define those parameters? You can't say it always has been like this because it exists in a certain form. So what defined its limitations or parameters? So the only conclusion anyone of common sense will come to is that this object was created by something else, caused by something else, a natural process, a stone cutter, whatever. So this is simple, common, everyday common sense on which we approach any subject you can think of, whether it be a painting, whether it be a waterfall, whether it be the planets, the sun, the cosmos. It's where you observe it like it is, and you ask every scientist or every observer, artist or whoever that observes any particular phenomenon will say, what caused it to have the certain attributes it has? Now, let me expand now our thinking from this rock to everything that we can see. The cosmos, as it's called, everything that exists. Now, we see from the cosmos that the cosmos has different components. Each components are finite, they're limited, they're jostling with each other with natural forces and so on and so forth, whether it be gravity or electromagnetic force, whether it be atoms or quantum particles smaller than we can detect. Whatever issue might be observing, whatever object from a planet or even a big massive galaxy, we see that it is limited, it has certain attributes. It is finite, it exists within a certain set of parameters for its existence. So let's apply the same criteria we do with it. Common household, so to speak, objects that we see. So did the universe make itself? No, because obviously it has to exist prior to doing something, and if it doesn't exist, then how can it make it bring itself into existence? Has the universe always existed? Now this one, because of the grand size of the universe, a lot of people are easily fooled into thinking that, well, maybe it has, because I haven't seen the whole universe, maybe it has always existed. Well, let me give it, and some people use this explanation that, yes, it's always existed in a kind of infinite chain of, you know, prior stages. So, for example, let's say there's a Big Bang, okay, fine, but before that, there was another type of universe which destroyed itself, and then it caused the next universe to exist, and so on. It's been doing that forever, ad infinitum. If this is the case, then do you think that infinity, an infinite chain of anything, can be transversed? That you can actually reach one point to point A to point B on an infinite chain? I mean, let's make it more simpler. Take some dominoes. Say I had a chain of dominoes, and I say it was infinitely large. Infinitely large chain of dominoes. Would any of those dominoes fall over? If the chain extended infinitely in the past, Would any of those dominoes, would you ever see the dominoes going past you and being knocked out? They would have to transverse an infinite amount of dominoes to get to any point in that domino chain. And how can you transverse infinity? How can you exhaust infinity? How can you, you know, fathom infinity, you can't. So nothing would exist then. Though, in this set, or maybe it's even another analogy then, of a similar kind. What analogy of a similar kind? Let's say that I was very poor, and I had no money to my name, and I wanted some money for a sandwich or something. And I needed £1, let's say it's a really cheap sandwich. And I got asked this brother over here, could you give me £1, brother, for a sandwich? And he too is very poor and has no money. And then he asked this brother, and he too has no money. And he asked this brother over there, and he too has no money. Ad infinitum, going on ad infinitum. Let's say that you asked an infinite amount of brothers, or infinite amount of people, who were poor, had no money to the name, but you asked an infinite amount of them for £1. Would you ever get £1? If they all didn't have any money, you wouldn't get nothing. And that's the thing. So you say there's an infinite chain of stages before this stage, an infinite chain of universes that created this, you reach this point in the universal chain. If it's infinite, we'd never reach this point. Nothing would exist. There'd be no start point to anything. So it can't be this. This would be completely absurd. And even now, cosmologists, even atheist ones, are acknowledging that there can't be an infinite regress. They have another theory. I'll get to that in a second. So then we arrive at the question, okay, so there must have been something else. The last possibility is that something else made this cosmos that we can observe all around us. Something else caused this cosmos to exist. What kind of thing is this now? What is it that started this universe, this cosmos, and so on? We have two possibilities. Either it was, again, an infinite chain of universes, which has been refuted, or it was an infinite, uncaused force. So, a force itself that has eternally existed and has no limits, no limitations on it. Because if it had limitations, then the question is, what define those limitations? So it can't. So it has to reach some point. I don't know where this point is. We have to reach some point where you say that then at some point there is a causer which has no limits and therefore does not need to be created itself or defined itself because it has no limit, essential limitations at some point. I don't know how where that point is, but at some point there must have been a causer, one that defined limits and caused things to exist, i.e. to create. So what is this thing? Well, this thing must also be absolute and self-subsistent, because if it wasn't self-subsistent, then it depends on something else to give it its existence, to cause it to exist, to maintain its existence. And since this thing, we postulated, was the beginning or was the cause of every other thing in the cosmos, then this thing has to be self-subsistent, not depending on anything else to maintain its existence or cause it to exist. This thing has to also be absolute, and absolute means that it has no divisions. It's not made of any substances itself. It has internal processes. Why do I say that? It's because if this thing, which caused everything to exist, had substances inside itself, then this thing is not the absolute cause. This thing, the substance is inside itself, its material, is the first cause, not the thing itself. And then the question is, okay, well, why can't you have something that has multiple components being the first cause? We'll get to that in a second. Does this force have a will? Is a very important question. Does it have a will? There are two possibilities to this. Either it has no will, it's random, and the atheists call this the multiverse theory, or the multiverse concept, which is essentially that there is some kind of multiverse that just shoots out random universes to an infinite degree. Shoots out random universes to an infinite degree. It has no intentionality behind it, just random process. Well, there are two problems with this. One, that what causes this multiverse to create these different... why is this multiverse have to create these multiple different universes? What makes it do it? If something is making it do it, then there is something behind this multiverse, which is making this multiverse having to make all these different infinite amount of universes. But I'm going to use an analogy for you. I call this the infinite factory line analogy. To take it as a factory line, and it produces an infinite amount of objects. Yeah, different kinds of objects, randomly. So it might produce a mobile phone, it might produce then suddenly a car, it might produce a widescreen TV, it might produce a jumbo jet. At any point in time, or any point in its production, it produces a jumbo jet, for example, then the question is, why did it produce a jumbo jet at that point in time and not a chair and not a mobile phone? Why did it, at that point in its production, it produced a jumbo jet? Why? What caused it to define the limits of that object as what it was? And this is the problem, because then there must be something else behind the multiverse that at any point in time decides what, or is causing it to make a certain product of a certain type or a certain shape and so on. So there can't be a multiverse, because the multiverse depends on something else to tell it what to do, to tell it to make universes, and to tell it what, and each particular universe, why it must be in that certain shape. So there must be something above or beyond this multiverse to do this. And the only possibility that's left is that this force has a will. And what do I mean by will? Will means that it chooses, it determines, it has intentionality, purposefulness. That this thing chooses, because choice is the ultimate cause. To choose something. I mean, if, for example, you put if a rock is just falling, being pushed by a stream, the rock has no choice. It's being moved by processes beyond its control. The stream is being pulled by gravity or seeking the ocean and so on and so forth. There's no choice in any of this. It's just a process. And of course, the process was set in action by previous processes or previous states. So the ultimate uncaused origin of anything has to be choice. Has to be something decided to choose. That's whatever it is created in that particular way. And it can't be, there is no rational explanation for that. It must be that it has a will. Now, what do we know so far? We know that an infinite force, let's say just call it force, exists. And this infinite force possesses a will. Now, if infinite force exists, which causes everything to exist, and it has a will, this fits the dictionary definition of God. The word God. So let's call it God then, for the sake of argument. Now, the second part is, how do we know that this God is one? How do you know there's not multiple gods? Maybe there could be multiple gods. Maybe there could be one God that has multiple components, like I mentioned earlier on. How do we know? Well, let's think this through. I'm going to posit that God is one in uniqueness, as in this being or whatever this thing is the only thing that exists of its like. How do I know this? Well, if there were multiple gods, let's say if there were three gods or four gods or five gods from eternity, then why four or five? Why not six or seven or 10 or 100? Why a specific number? Who defined this number? You see, if something is numbered or multiple, or there's multiples of it, then there is an origin for it. Because what made these different things all having the same power or the same thing existent? For example, if you see a can of Pepsi for the first time, and then you see 10 other cans of Pepsi, you can deduce that there must have been something that's creating all these Pepsis, because there's multiples of them. But secondly, and this is perhaps the more important one, is that if there is a plurality of infinite beings, then they limit each other. And if they limit each other, then they're not unlimited, and they're not infinite. They're finite, they're limited, they've got limits. And if they're limits, if they have limits and parameters, then they are created. It's a simple argument. I'll show a little bit about where, from Islamic sources, the same argument is used. But this is the final one. If there are many gods, then can one god destroy another god? If yes, then that god is more powerful than the other gods. If no, then that god is not God. Can't decide, can't do. Wouldn't be infinite, wouldn't be omnipotent, would it? And now, the second point is, I'm going to posit that God is one in composition, so he's absolute, he's fundamental, there's nothing, you can't divide him further. And my proof of this is, if there is a plurality within God, if there's multiple components within God, and God is infinite, then you have multiple infinites. If God is infinite, everything inside it must be infinite too. So, quote unquote, inside must be infinite too. And if these are all infinite and they are different components, then that's multiple gods, and you fall into the same problem. As I said, with having multiple gods in the first place. This is also the same argument people use against the Christian concept of the Trinity. there is three gods within one God, and which one is the most powerful. The second point is the impossibility of substance within God, because if God is infinite and unlimited, then how can there be, and he's the most, he's the first cause, then how can there be something more fundamental than him that causes him? I mean, your arms, your legs, your eyes, your face, the cells in your body define what you are. They define what you are. The cell, your genetic code defines what you are. So, this is something that's more fundamental than you. You are now a composite, and this thing defines you. Now, if God is made up of a substance, then there is something inside him that is in reality, that is God, because that is defining what God is, gives him his powers. So that thing is actually God, not God itself. So it doesn't work. And thirdly, that God is not subject to a previous disposition or nature. God doesn't have a nature that compels him to do what he has to do. Because if his sight is compelling him, like, you know, he's got instincts, for example, like we, like creatures have, then these instincts are more fundamental than God. It is a prior cause to God, and therefore God is not God. He's being forced to do things by a sight even greater than him. So what I'm saying is that my first line of argument was that there must be something, I don't know in where it is, but there must be something that is the ultimate cause, and there is nothing, it's not intermediate for anything else. It's the ultimate cause. I don't know what it is or how far the chain of causality is. All I know is that there is something as ultimate cause. And if I imagine anything, substance or nature or plurality within God, these things are not the ultimate things. These things are just intermediaries. Like we are the made up of the substance. Our cells are more fundamental than us. Genetics are more fundamental than ourselves. So we're not the most fundamental aspect of ourselves. And our genes are, our atoms are, and you can break it down even smaller. So, in summary, God exists. God exists, and he possesses omnipotence. As in infinite, he's not limited. There's no limits or parameters on existence. God possesses will and intentionality. If he's infinite and he has will, this is the definition of God. This is what God is, a God. If he had infinite power but no will, it would just be a process like the multiverse, as the atheists like to claim. God is unique. There are no other gods, because if he exists with other gods, then he would be limited by them, and they all wouldn't be God. There'd be something beyond them that created them in the first place. And even if you look at pagan theologies, which have multiple gods, there is always a father god, a head god, that create all other gods, the demigods. Always. You'll always notice this, that even they realize, at some basic level, that all these gods, where did they all come from? It must have been a head god that started the whole family, so to speak. And God is indivisible and absolute, because whatever this thing is the first cause, and there can't be anything beyond him, or so he can't have a substance, he can't be divided, and there is nothing beyond him or that transcends him. And God is not subject to internal processes or nature. So there's nothing that is inside him that's an internal process that he can't control. If that's the case, then those internal processes or that nature is God and not God himself. So for example, we are slaves to our instincts. Our instincts compel us to do actions, and obviously we have the will to choose how we satisfy those actions, our fitrah, according to the Arabic concept of it, our nature. Whereas God doesn't have a fitrah, God doesn't have a nature, because he wasn't defined as such. And inshallah, I think these are the proofs of how we know, and I've kept it very, you know, basic as I can, how we know that God exists, how anyone can know that God exists, and that there's only one ultimate origin of which there can be no other that shares its highest attribute of being the ultimate causer of everything that exists. And I'll finish off with just highlighting a few surahs of the Quran which show these points. For example, in Surah 21, verse 22, and it says, and why were there gods on heaven and earth? Other than God, they would surely go to ruin. So they would all fight each other, and everything that exists, or if one god was to create something, for example, the other gods could change it and destroy it, and they'd fight, and they'd be limited. So the Quran uses this very same argument, that if there's more than one god, then how is there going to be, there will be tumult and jostling forces that fight each other, and in essence, they would, none of them would be God, because they'll be like bickering creation as we fight each other because we are limited and we all clash with each other. And also, the Surah Al-Ikhlas, the Surah 112, in the name of Allah, the Merciful and Compassionate, say, O Muhammad, He is Allah, the One, the Self-Sufficient, who is not begotten, nor did He beget, and there is none equal to Him. And if you contemplate this verse, it has virtually every aspect of the argument which I presented today. So, although this is a very generic discussion, I'd like to posit that Islam, in the vein of people who believe in one God and believe in a Unitarian concept, as in there's no other gods, Islam is one of the most purest manifestations of this concept, and I invite you to read the Quran to understand the Islamic conception of God, which I think offers one of the best accounts of the existence of God and the unitary existence of God.
Jazakallah, Brother Abdullah, for this informative talk. If there are any questions you want to ask or any comments, I'll open the floor for any comments or any questions. And please make sure that the questions are related to today's topic. And just another couple of announcements for tomorrow. There's going to be a general Q&A. Any questions you want to ask about Islam. And on Thursday, there's going to be a talk on Isa alayhi salam. So inshallah, you know, please attend that as well. Any questions? Raise your hands. You can either write your questions on a piece of paper or raise your hands.
Feel free to play devil's advocate and just challenge me. The more you challenge, the more you'll actually solidify the concept in your minds. So try and see if you can find any refutation or some part of that you think there is a hole in it. Try and actually invoke it, just for the sake of everyone to see, you know, what, you know, if the idea can hold up to criticism. I think my talk was that good.
I just didn't understand the atheist concept of multiverse is creating universes. So if you could just talk to us through that.
Sure. Well, I can just explain then the atheist concept of the multiverse. What they believe is that they try to understand as to, well, what caused this universe to come to existence with its limitations that it has. And if they should go down the path of what's intentional, then they have to go lead to theism, and they don't want to do this. So they try to find a different explanation. And the different explanation was that it was this universe is the result of a random process. But the question is, a random process of what? So they had this idea of a multiverse, which is there is an infinite number of universes. And this universe exists as one of that infinite number of every possibility of universe you can ever imagine and beyond. This is their concept. So there's an infinite number, and we just happen to be in one of those many variations. We just happen to be in one particular variation of infinite number of universes. This is the concept of multiverse. And the refutation to this is, well, in this particular universe, or any particular universe you might pick in their model and then that they have, why does each particular universe have the specific limitations that it has? What decided that? Or what produced that? And then they come stuck. Because then they have to say, well, maybe another multiverse. And what did that do? Or maybe another ad infinitum to infinity. And of course, then they fall foul of the infinite regress argument, which is the infinite chain of things can't exist. And even they are willing to admit this. But there's something very interesting that even when they talk about their multiverse, which in essence you could say is the atheist God, it's a random God, is that they have to use the word infinite. The word infinite always comes, it always has to be used by someone at some point. And infinite is the realm of God, right? This is the attribute of God. But even if they say infinite regress or infinite amount of universe, they have to always use the word infinite. For enough, you just can't escape from the concept of infinity. There must be at some point some infinity. Now the question is, as to what kind of infinity it is. Is it an infinity that has finite things in it? Or is it an infinity that is purely infinite? And this is the concept that we, as theists, hold on to. That it's a concept that's of infinite that is purely infinite, not contradictory. How can something infinite have finite things inside it? It's just contradictory. It's infinite and it's finite at the same time. It doesn't make sense. So we want people to be consistent. If you're going to believe it, if you're going to use the word infinite, be consistent. Infinite in everything. Not just infinite in its time span, infinite in existence, or infinite chains. No, it had, it's infinite in everything.
I'm glad you brought that out, because I have to ask a question.
Sure.
Basically, there's a theory that Hayes uses that where the universe is infinite, and we're in the process of a finite sort of process in between infinity. But in regards to what you just said, is that you know, being in a finite process, you can have finite things. That's acceptable. So it can go like against what you said.
Well, in a finite process.
Yeah, we're in a finite process, and we're not finite objects.
Sure.
And processes within that.
Yeah.
So in that essence, that's acceptable. Whereas you just said that you can't have infinite in finite.
Yeah. You can't have infinite in finite, and you can't have finite in infinite.
Yeah.
But you can have finite in finite.
Yeah.
So I wonder if that makes sense, everybody. But what was the contention? Sorry.
It's because there's like an infinite process going on.
Oh, you mean like in an infinite chain of time frames or stages or what have you, we're just one finite part of that.
Yeah.
Yeah? But there's still the problem, how do you get from the infinite chain, whatever, from eternity to now? How do you, how do you get to that, to this point in an infinite chain?
Well, the atheist says that there's some sort of trigger in between that time, where there's some sort of causation that, I forgot what they call it, but it triggers it off and it brings in a finite sort of.
But they just said there must be causation then, so then they fall into the first argument that there has to be a cause for finite things to begin. Yeah. Okay, alright, playing their game, we say, okay, God's existence is infinite, and at some point he initiated a finite process. Not some point in his existence, but some point in the finite existence. Finite just popped into existence, and it goes to a finite start and a finite end. Yeah, we believe this. But it doesn't contradict our belief that God is infinite. And just maybe too, because you might go back and think about this, God is not in time or not in a chain of causality. He just exists. So there was no, at some point in his infinity, which you can't have, he decided to make the finite. No, he doesn't exist in a chain of chain of time or a chain of time frame or whatever. And when he creates, we don't know, how can we understand this? We can't comprehend how infinite creates something from nothing, and where does this nothing exist in and where does the infinite exist? We can't even ask that question, because it doesn't make sense. There's no location. Location is also finite. So the created just pops into existence, the created things, and exists for a certain time, or a certain amount of change, time is change, and then stops existing. And that's all we can comprehend rationally. I hope that sounds to your point, or made you more confused.
Thank you.
But then, does that mean that we are finite or infinite?
We're finite.
We're finite. So what happens after we die?
Well, what happens after we die? Well, we still exist as a different kind of finite thing. From the Muslim perspective, of course, then we obviously believe in an afterlife. An afterlife is another kind of finite existence.
It's finite existence.
We all have a shape, we all have a size, a form, and this is finite existence.
So, after you die, does it mean that you live forever in paradise? Or
don't confuse living without end from final infinite, because any point in time, if I was to go to any point in time in the hereafter and measure how much time has passed, it would always be finite. So I could go 1,000 years into the hereafter, and it would still be 1,000 years have passed. I can go 10,000 years into. I can't go into the infinite amount of time into the future afterlife, because you can't cross infinity. So at any point in time in the hereafter, according to the theist perspective, it would always be a finite amount of time has always passed. But it's just that God, his existence doesn't end, chooses to perpetuate the existence of the finite.
That's the paradise.
Or hell, depending on. There's not a place. Let's not forget it.
Well, I'm still not clear about the concept that you just mentioned right now, about being finite after...
Okay, let me give an example. The people say the number line is infinite, but it's not. The number line is just a counting ball. That's all it is. So how to count. That's all it is. You can't say the number line doesn't exist in reality. It is a set of just the rules of, you know, plus one, and then you change this. If it reaches 10, then you, in the decimal system, of course, then you must add a zero and so on. So it's just a counting ball. All it is. And it only goes as far as you can count, or as the best computer can count. But the best computer, or the best mind, can only count to a finite amount. So it's just like the hereafter, that there is no end, there is no end, just like the number line, there is no end to how much you can count, but at any point in time of your counting, you only have counted a finite amount of numbers, or a finite amount of time in hereafter, and so on. So it's not infinite. Infinite means with no limit, whereas we are limited by the amount of time at each point in time that that you want to measure, like the time frame. Don't know if that makes sense. anyone else? Do you understand?
I understand.
Can you get it?
Alright,
making sure I'm going to try it. I'll ask a few more questions and I'll come back to you again. I want to see if I can give you a little knowledge and then it might make sense to you.
Yeah. So if you pose a question to Mr. Brahma, he said, then can God create something that he cannot destroy? Similar to the scenario that he gave earlier, can one God destroy another one if not? So how would you tackle that problem?
Sure. Well, it's very simple. They go back to the argument of, can God make something more heavy than he can lift, is the most common one. And the question is not about, you know, can or can't, is the real question is, does God limit himself? Like, make himself limited. And if he makes himself limited, then he's no longer God. You see? And so he couldn't do that if he was no longer God. So it's like saying, if God ceases to become God and becomes limited, can he, you know, count to infinity? Well, no, because he's limited now, isn't he? So if God can make something heavier than he could lift, more heavy than he could lift, this is like him making him a God as well, and then he'd be limited, and then none will be God, and everything would cease to exist. Because there's no cause, there's no maintainer.
What's up? Claim that there was that.
Please?
You know, God is all powerful, so in essence, he has the power to become limiting something and then destroying it once again.
God can do anything, but he is not anything. You see? God can do anything, but he is not anything. Because the definition of infinite comes from the Latin infinis, which means not finite. So when you say God is infinite, you are already saying that God is something he's not. There's something he's not. And he is not finite. So what the question is saying is that can infinite be not finite, which is a contradiction. You see? Because God is, you know, as I said, God can do anything. He can create and has infinite power. But he himself is not anything. He is not finite. So to say, can he make something heavier than he could lift, is essentially saying, can God be finite and still have infinite power? Well, obviously he can't be finite and still have infinite power. Because he's not only God. Does that make sense? I don't know if I've baffled everyone. But it's a good question, it's a very good question.
A couple of questions here. Says one question is, what if one doubts and doesn't understand the command of Allah and why Allah says certain things? How do we fully submit to the command of Allah even if we don't understand it?
Okay. Well, understanding is not a prerequisite to obeying. People give us orders all the time which we don't understand when we do it. For example, you might be told that you can't go into London's day, there's a big traffic disturbance and you can't go into central London, and you say, okay, I'll just go around it. You don't say, no, I'm going to keep going in until someone tells me why I can't go into central London, what's causing this. Yeah, all that's necessary for a human being to know is that it exists. Something exists, a command, an issue, a problem, I mean, we all the time, we say, I want to have some ice cream today. Why? I feel like it. Why don't you question, no, do you question why you feel like it? Why you must do that? No, you just say, well, I just feel like it. Just do it. We don't understand. Obviously, looking into it, it could be our body has a deficiency of sugar, it's telling our brain to find sugar, and therefore we are subconsciously get ice cream. Maybe that's the explanation. But do you think like this? Do you understand like that? No, you just feel like ice cream, or feel like some, you know, raiding some sweet shop, and so on, and then having to go to the dentist afterwards. So this is, you know, this is what we don't need to understand something to follow it. However, many things are explained in terms of the commands of God. Many commands of God are explained for our benefit, and they're explained because we need to know this explanation in order to follow that command better. But I'll just give an example from this in the Muslim perspective, and the Jewish perspective, which is we're not allowed to eat pork. Is there a reason given? No, no reason given. But in all circumstances, you know not to eat pork. You know, there's no situation whereby, well, maybe I do need to eat pork. Well, no, you don't need to eat pork. However, when the Quran is advising on, let's say, foreign policy of a Muslim man, saying that tether your horses, your steeds of war, to strike fear into the hearts of enemies. So those people who want to hurt you or hurt the lands under control, let's say, by Muslims. And you should develop, you should get your steeds of war, your horses, and make sure that they strike fear into the hearts of enemies, they won't attack you. You're defended by people's fear of you, they won't attack you. But in today's world, if you came with horses, you'd strike humor into the hearts of the enemy. And they probably would invade. But then what does the verse of Quran say? It says, so that you can strike fear. So this is what they call the illah, the reason behind it. And from this reason, we know that if we can apply it in today's world, we'll need tanks, planes, submarines, and so on and so forth. You see, if the reason is given, so in a different context, we know how to follow that rule. But rules that don't have that are just given to us, then don't require us to know the reason behind it. We're told not to do it, and no situation is going to turn up whereby knowing the reason will be of any benefit to us. And if you think about it, God created us. From our perspective, almost arbitrarily, he willed us to exist, not because he had a desire he needs to fulfill or a previous nature causing him to do that, because he got bored or whatever. No, he just decided for us to exist. So if we can't understand the very cause of why God even made us in the first place, and what I mean by why is in what prompted him to do it, and nothing can prompt him to do it. He does it literally, and we can't understand this, because for us, we always have a cause why we make a decision, whereas God just does it. So if we can't understand that, then how can we, of course, by analogy, we also, a lot of the commands of God, which is now fulfilling our purpose, which he has ordained for us, will, a lot of them, we won't know the reason for it. But the very fact that they're commands, and the fact that our purpose is given, that, you know, he's not created man or jinn except to worship him. Worship is to obey. So there has to, in order to obey God, to have that choice, to fill our purpose, we have to have commands. If there's no commands, then there's no, how can we obey? How can we make that choice? Use our free will to make that choice in the first place and fulfill our purpose to worship. We can't, so you need commands to give us the law in the first place. So then we can make that choice. And of course, I could go on about this, but you know, these commands will fit our human nature and so on, so that's a different discussion. But suffice to say, I hope I've answered that satisfactorily. Please come back if I haven't. Another question there? If there is a God, how does he deal justly with creation? Interesting question. I suppose the real question is, what is justice? What is being just in the first place? I would say that dealing justly with creation is giving the creation the ability to realize itself, to be what it was intended to be at some point. To be, for example, if a human being is not satisfied in this life and has, let's say, he lives in a very difficult time and he's suppressed or oppressed, then in the hereafter, to create balance between him and his lack of realizing who he truly was as a human being, the fitra, he is given a redress, a balance in the hereafter. And this is justice. Obviously, how does God give justice to a rock? Well, the rock has already got justice because it only exists to exist, and God has allowed it to be what it is. So even if we can't realize our full nature because we are oppressed or there's a certain problem that we live in a very troublesome time or area, God will always redress that balance in the hereafter, and hence justice will be complete. So that anything can be fully realized. And let me give another example. Let's say there's a husband and he doesn't treat his wife properly, and his wife feels that she doesn't have a fully loving relationship with her husband. And she will, and then she will take the husband to court, the Islamic court, and they will say, she'll say, my husband hasn't done justice to me. Why she use that word? Because he hasn't allowed me my full rights as a human being, a creation with the fitrah, with human nature. So either the judge will get justice, the judge will demand that the husband fulfills those rights, or if the court doesn't exist and the husband gets away with it, then in the day of judgment, Allah will make sure that the rights are fulfilled by balancing it with a suitable punishment. And if you could think about what punishment is, it is a frustration of your humanity. So pain is a frustration of who you are. We always seek to be, we seek pleasure, because pleasure is what we perceive to be our satisfying our central nature. So the concept of hell is the permanent frustration of human nature. Pain, that you feel unhappy, you feel obviously that you can't, you know, not at peace with yourself. So God redresses it in that sense with creation that has a soul and has will. And with creation that has no will, like rocks and the mountains and so on, then their justice is them existing. The justice given to them is that they exist. And that's essentially, I guess, that according to my definition of justice, is how God gives justice to his creation. Why did God create us all as Muslims and test us? Why create non-Muslims knowing they won't believe? Well, if you think about it, we have free will. Why do we have free will? Now, why did God create us with free will? Why did God just not create one of these kind of, a bunch of robots that will just worship him or say that he is great, infinite, and so on? Why not this? Why did he have to create free will in the first place? Because if there's this kind of self-help cassettes, or back in the day called cassettes, where you put them in and you listen, and you go to sleep and it says you are a strong, confident person, and yada, yada, yada. Make yourself feel better about yourself, and so on. But that doesn't have any real value to it, does it? Because it's the tape will play that for anyone. It doesn't matter who's listening. There's no value in this. So where does real value come from? Real value comes from choice. Choosing. You have to choose. Now, the question is, why don't God just create Muslims and test us, and why did he create non-Muslims? Well, here's a great concept of justice to give to you, actually, a great understanding of justice. Imagine, and I'm talking strictly from the Islamic perspective here and so on. Imagine that there is a poor person, a person that was born into a poor family, and a person born into a rich family. The poor person has the same obligations to be a moral and virtuous person as the rich person. But, according to God's justice, the rich person will be accounted more by God, more questions will be asked of him, because he had more power given to him to do good, to be virtuous, to help his fellow human being, whereas the poor person maybe could just about help his family and having much money. The more blessing you have, the more responsibility you have, and the more you are accounted for it. Some could say that the more blessing you have is almost more of a curse as well. Because a rich person giving lots of blessing of riches, most rich people forget about their duties to their fellow human beings and become arrogant and don't do that. And therefore their riches was a curse for them. And maybe they wished on the day of judgment they were poor and didn't have that temptation in the first place. So likewise, a non-Muslim only is accounted for believing in God and believing in one God and doing the best he can with whatever virtues and morals in his society followed. That's all he's accounted for. We're actually accounted more harsher than the non-Muslim that never had the option. So a guy in the Amazon rainforest is not going to be accounted for by God for why he wasn't a Muslim, because he didn't know about it. Maybe even, according to a lot of scholars, those people who even might have heard of Islam, but thought it was a religion like every other kind of religion, maybe didn't think about it or had the opportunity to know about it. Maybe, you know, Allah will also be leaning on them. Allahu Alam, this is obviously one of those best. But they will be counted less than a Muslim. A Muslim will be counted much harsher because you had all the guidance. You had all the guidance to make your life easier. What did you do with that now? Whereas non-Muslim will just be asked, did you believe in God? Did you believe only one God? And did you do the best you can with what you knew or what you thought was good? Maybe they took interest. They didn't know it was bad. Will God punish them for that? No, because they didn't know about the commands. Or they didn't know there was commands from God that said interest was bad. They won't be accounted for it. If we did it, we'd be punished for it. So with every blessing, there is greater responsibility. And for some people, they will regret the blessings that they got. So for Muslims, this is actually very scary, because the non-Muslims, a lot of non-Muslims out there, or had that or existed in the history, will not be accounted as worse, as harsh as we are. But we got the blessing to make our lives easier by having guidance that allows us to fulfill our fitrah, our human nature, and seek peace in this world and inshallah in the next. So bear that in mind. I think it's the last question from the sisters, and then it's the last one there is there. How can there be a God if there is so much evil in the world? This question, very interesting question. Atheists ask this. There's an assumption behind this. The assumption is that the purpose of our existence is to enjoy ourselves. And this is a lot come up from the Western society, a lot of the Western society. And in this society, people want to enjoy themselves. And they are told that the purpose of your life is to fulfill your desires whichever way you deem fit, whatever way you like. And the purpose of your life is to enjoy yourself. And a lot of these people, coming from an ex-Christian background, or coming from a Christian legacy, so to speak, from the Western countries, still believed in the God. They still held this idea that God exists. But they were told this new ideology, which is called, I guess, liberalism, that you're meant to enjoy your life. The purpose of life is to enjoy it to the max. So then they simply ask themselves the question, well, if my purpose in my life is to enjoy myself, and God created me, why is he denying me this enjoyment? Why is life full of misery? And why is life full of hardship and tests? But they've made the wrong assumption. Who told you that the purpose of life is to enjoy yourself? I'm not saying you should be miserable, but it's as one, I think, hadith from the Prophet Muhammad put it, to people who have denied the truth, who don't want to follow truth, they've made this their paradise. But to a person who wants to follow truth, to one who believes in truth, or the truth, this is their prison. And interesting, he didn't say this is their hell, this is their prison. Why? Because even in prison you get enjoyments. There are miseries and there are enjoyments. Even in the prison, there's balance. And if there was no balance, then where is the tests? You can only make a choice when you're given two options. And you have to obviously be wanting to avert harm from yourself or misery from yourself to make these options. Like, should I invest in houses or should I invest in cars as a business? I don't want to lose money and be poor and be destitute because then I won't be able to feed my family. That's a hardship, so I'm going to try and make the best decision. This motivates me to choose. So the good and bad exist to give you the motivations to choose. But we have to now, as upon us, to make the right choice, not just about avoiding the harms and trying to seek good, but also seeking the transcendent good, as in following our purpose in life, which is the ultimate good, and avoiding purpose. And let me even give a definition of what is good and what is evil, because people like assume, they just say evil, good. What is evil and good? The definition of good in Islam, or actually maybe I'll start from an analogy of a better thing. What makes a good car? Yeah? What do you think? What do you think makes a good car? When you said this car is good, what do you think? Suggestions?
Get you to A and B reliably.
Okay. Anything else? Fuel economy, very important in the recession.
Appearance.
Oh, you like your car, don't you? Engine. Okay, fine. So, the car is meant to be for transportation. It's meant to be, you know, to get you. The purpose of the car is to get you from A to B quicker than just walking. That's the point of it. So, the better it fulfills its purpose, the more good a car it is, yes? So if we have a purpose, then those who fulfill our purpose more are good. Fulfilling your purpose is good. And what is bad? What is a bad car? Car with no engine, car with the wheels taken off, car that breaks down every 5 minutes, bad car. Why? Because it doesn't fit its purpose. So the good and the evil, the good and the bad is what follows the purpose and what doesn't follow the purpose. And when people say, how can your God be a good God and is evil in the world? I say, but God defines purpose. He doesn't follow a purpose. You can't even say that God is good, as the Christian might say, God is good. Like, God, there's something greater than God called good, and God just happens to be following this thing which is greater than him called good. No, God defines the purpose of what is good and bad. And we are the ones who are judged whether good and bad, not God. So once you understand this, then you realize that this question has no meaning for us. It's assumed from Christian theology and, of course, the modern Western mentality of the purpose of life is to enjoy. And so why is there so much misery in the world? Anyway, the sister, in the back.
So, from an Islam perspective, obviously looking at that, Islam is a test, and it's the next one that's being turned on. So, in terms of that question, you just really hope to
be the question, how can there be a God if there is so much evil in the world?
Obviously, it's Muslims, we believe that this world is a test, so obviously that necessitates both hardship and peace. And in terms of the example here, the Prophet of Allah said that he used that as one being a believer, prison for the believer and baptized for the non-believer. Again, you mentioned how sort of just get out of prison and it.
So in a prison you have hardships and pleasures.
You said that prison tells that there is still some sort of enjoyment.
Yes.
In that, you say that prison also tells that one day you will be free.
Yes.
And that prison for the next time.
Yes.
Okay, and what do the philosophers and atheists want to say in terms of these which aren't as a proof, in terms of they can't alter it in terms of what was created or written by the different man?
Oh, you mean the proof of the Quran? How do you know the Quran is from God? Using it as an evidence. Okay. All these rational arguments I've quoted, it's all in the Quran. Nothing you can't find in the Quran. The Quran, one of its main, the first verse that engage with you is, do the disbelievers not see? Or do you not see the ayat of Allah, the signs of God? The ayat can mean proof as well. The signs of God, the proofs of God in everything, in the alternation of night and day, which is obviously the phase of time and change. All these things, the planets, the mountains, even man-made things that travel around the world, the ships and so on, that bring what is good for man. All these, this is all signs. If you contemplate this, these are signs. And it's the first basis. Now, Muslims make the mistake of just quoting the verse, thinking the verse itself, as the verse, will just change someone's mind. And they miss the substance. Now, the verse is asking you to understand the meaning, and the meaning is pointing you in the right direction. The first revelation of God is everything that exists. Everything that exists is the ayat of Allah. And it's very interesting because the word ayat also can apply for a paragraph of the Quran. So it's ayat of the Quran as well. So in some ways, I like to explain it as that there's almost, you could say, like two holy books. One is the first revelation of God. He created everything in existence, which attests to his existence. And of course, the Quran. And the Quran is pointing people who are atheists or whoever to the wider creation, saying, look. And let me give an example. The Prophet Muhammad, how he handled an atheist. He met a Bedouin who was an atheist. And before he approached this guy, this companion, the Prophet Muhammad, had been debating for hours with this Bedouin atheist. Hours. And the guy wasn't budging. So the Prophet Muhammad, sat down. And this guy was a Bedouin. And he just said that, look, if you saw hoof prints in the sand, if you saw hoof prints in the sand, but you saw nothing around, what would you conclude? You'd say, well, there must have been a camel. Or there must have been, obviously, something that created a camel. It went by. But even though you didn't see it, and a Bedouin said, yeah, you never even see it, there must have been a camel. So then the Prophet Muhammad, salam, said, well, look at the stars in the sky. These are the footprints of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Not literally, of course, but it's the same things that are caused, which you don't see the causer, but you see the effect. You don't see the cause, you see the effect. And then the Bedouin said, "Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah." The Bedouin realized, because the Bedouin then could understand from his own world how very simple common sense, causality, how it applies when you look at the cosmos. And the Prophet didn't just quote verses of the Quran in him and saying, "Well, you know, you're believing God just because of these verses of the Quran." No, the Prophet engaged with a very rational discussion. And the Quran itself urges you to look at the universe and point to that as evidence. And then after they believe in God, not they believe in one God, which you can demonstrate purely rationally, then the discussion goes into, well, how do we know that the Quran is from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? And that's a different discussion. Very interesting one, but I want to just keep on topic for the time being. Time's limited, like many things in this universe. Actually, just one small point. I think maybe just to follow on from that question about why there's so much evil in the world. If you think about it, even from a different perspective, what is evil? If it's evil is a person choosing to do something bad, well, this is free will. This is why Allah gave us free will to fulfill our purpose. And when one person does with his free will hurts someone else, God has justice, redress for this to equal, so that there is no, evil doesn't prevail, if you want to look at it from this. But if a tsunami happens or an earthquake and people die and so on, you say, "Oh, that's evil." So who says it's evil? You're going to die anyway at some point, and you're going to go to hereafter at some point. Why is dying earlier than you think you would, or dying later than you think you would, evil or good in the great grand scheme of things? Even to an atheist, you say, "Well, it's an atheist, they should even believe in evil. Just things just happened," as they say. They don't even believe in evil or good, if you really, you know, push it down to it. So the natural disasters, or whatever you want to call them, are not evil intrinsically. And you're going to die at any point in time anyway. So what makes death evil intrinsically if you're all going to die anyway? So, and it's just transitioning to a different existence. That's all. So anyway.
So, are there any other questions you want to ask?
Yeah, that's a big question.
Yes.
Do you believe that God has always existed in time, or God, if God created?
Do I believe that God exists in time?
The argument is God is infinite. Kind of being that God always exists in time. But didn't God create time itself?
No, God doesn't exist in time. Time itself is a limited construction. You could say it enables change.
If you're saying finite and infinite, assuming that he's always existed in time, but where time didn't even exist, God create time as he existed outside time itself?
Well, yes, God is not in time because he's not limited by anything. He's not subject to anything. Time subjects everything within its space. Time and space is also linked together, of course. It subjects everything to change. But God doesn't change because if an infinite thing does change, then there will be now a chain of causality, which you can't have an infinite chain of causality. So from this I can deduce that God is outside of time and doesn't change. And whereas that which exists, which he created, is create time, create space, create objects within time and space as well. No? I think I've exhausted the audience now.
Oh, so just a small question.
Yes.
So the justice that you mentioned previously about if you're an ombudsman and if you have no concept of why you're Islam, then you're not going to judge harshly. But then, let's say for an unbeliever, if you don't fit from a religious sect or different religion altogether, and you do know, if you do that, you know that you're...
To be a Catholic, there's two things. One, you have to know what the truth is and be convinced. Your mind, who investigates, would have said, "Yeah, you know what? I'm pretty convinced that this is probably better or is more probable or makes more sense than what I'm following now." And two, that you made the conscious decision to ignore that. Now, do I know, looking at a non-Muslim, if they are a kafir, really in the true reality of it? Well, I can't see into people's hearts. You could be a person who could say that he's a Muslim, but not be a practicing Muslim. They could just follow it because everyone else was following it. They're born to a family, they don't follow it. Like in the Islam, we call it a munafiq, a hypocrite. They portray Islam, but in reality, they they're just pragmatic people. They just follow what everyone else is doing because it's easier. So only Allah knows, God knows what's inside people's hearts. That's not for us to make that judgment. And I'll say that I defer that to Allah because Allah's judgment is far better than my judgment or anyone else's judgment. Only Allah knows, and this is on a case-by-case basis between that person and God. What I will say is, just in case people are confused, but in the legal sense, and as in how we use it in the legal sense, we call a person a Muslim, even if they're not fully practicing, we might say they are a Muslim. And if a person is non-Muslim, then the word kafir can mean just generically non-Muslim, as a generic word, non-Muslim. So it's not a bad word. It just it's used in that sense. But how does anyone know if someone's a real kafir? Well, it's only Allah knows this, and we have to defer that to Allah in their judgment. He knows better. So if a non-Muslim can, with a clear conscience, say to God, "Look, if I had known that Islam was the truth, I would have followed it," then I leave that between them and God, and so on. And there's many hadiths talking about people and their judgment. They said, if I had known the truth, I would have followed it. And then there would be a test, perhaps given to them there, or some kind of Allah would deal with it as He sees fit. But justice will be done to that person. So in essence, not every non-Muslim will go to hell. That's on the bottom line, just because they're non-Muslim. Obviously, there are. Allah will ask. I said I'm going to rinse them out now.
Is there any more questions? I'll just close the panel for now. Just a quick reminder for tomorrow, there's going to be a general Islamic Q&A tomorrow. What time is it? 1:30. Okay. And on Thursday is going to be a talk on Isa alayhi salam. And I say inshallah, thank you for attending today's talk. Jazakallah khairan. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.